what was once a captivating, trend-setting program has now deteriorated into a cliched, let's be honest, boring, snooze fest. Television ratings, downward spiral. Pay-per-view buy rates, plummeting. Mainstream acceptance, non-existent. And reactions of the live crowds, complete and utter silence. And I know why you're silent. You're silent because you're embarrassed to be here. And the reason why you're embarrassed is because of the steady stream of uninteresting, untalented, mediocre sports entertainers who you're forced to cheer for and care for. No wonder you're not cheering. You can care less about every single idiot in that dressing room.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
How scary is it to listen back to that Jericho quote now? Yeah, I was reading The Observer last week, and Dave had that quote printed in there, so I went back and I found it. I said, I have to use this as an intro for the show. Listening back to that now? Very scary. It's a lot of news to get to this week. We have two former TNA champions are leaving the company. Hulk Hogan dropping the big boot on Gawker. May end up being a dusty finish, though, because he's probably not going to see any of that money. Sting unofficially retired, according to TMZ. We have a lot to get to here. This is episode 431 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, March 20th, 2016, here on the anniversary of the Bret Hart vs. Owen Hart match at WrestleMania 10, the Shawn Michaels Razor Ramon ladder match at WrestleMania 10. It was March 20, 1994. I remember that Mania well. I wasn't there for Mania itself, but I was there for the very first Fan Fest. And that was where I got to meet Vince McMahon, and you can find that picture on my Facebook page of Vince in his three-piece suit smiling into the camera, and I am so interested that I am looking somewhere else. I am attending my first Evolve show tonight. I am looking forward to that, having a show here in Brooklyn. Brian Blade is joining me. William Regal was at last night's Evolve show. He is going to be at the show tonight in Brooklyn as well. And I know last night, he made the announcement that qualifying matches for WWE's Global Cruiserweight Tournament, or some of them anyway, are going to be held in Evolve, which is pretty cool. So if he announces anything cool at tonight's show, I will post it on Twitter. Audible is still offering listeners of The Sound Off a free 30-day trial of its service. You can check it out right now. Use our URL to sign up, audibletrial.com/solomonster. You can sample it for an entire month. And if it is not to your liking, you will not be billed in those 30 days. You are under no obligation whatsoever. But if you sign up, what you do get is one free audiobook download. And it could be any book that they offer of your choosing. And they have over 180,000 of them to pick. A lot of wrestling books, obviously more non-wrestling books. But you can get a free book out of it if nothing else. But a lot of people have signed up for the service and have stuck with it. They actually enjoy it. I think you will too. And if not, you don't lose anything. You get a free book, so it's a win-win situation. Just use our URL, because when you do, you help out the podcast. So sign up at audibletrial.com/solomonster. Check it out. Get your free audiobook on us. And also, we have two new shirts up in our store on Pro Wrestling Tees. ProWrestlingTees.com/solomonstersoundsoff. We have two 1992-themed, Rumble 1992-themed shirts up there. And of course, a ton of other ones. And I want to thank, there have been a lot of people who have bought shirts in the last couple of weeks. I don't know if people are stocking up on shirts because they want to bring them to Dallas for WrestleMania. I don't know what's going on, but I thank you for that. So head on over there. And I don't know, you know, it's tough because sometimes it takes 2 or 3 weeks to get those shirts. So I think if you order them now, I'm not sure if you're going to get them in time for Dallas, but I certainly wouldn't wait longer. If you want to give it a shot, I would hop on that right now. And also, thank you for those who have made a donation via PayPal, you can always do so on thesolemonster.com. You see the box on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname, courtesy of moi, and a shout-out here on the show. Thank you very much to Super Supreme Style 702, if that is your real name, Chuck Lunatic Lentz, John Loose Cannon Lopez, The Bronx Bomber, Robert Hordines, The Chosen Son, Andre Smith, Damn Straight Michael Dorsey, Dream Chaser Chauncey Curry, Nowhere to Run, Chris Hearn, Angel Eyes, Amber Pittman, and Handsome Devil, Eric Pesek. Thank you very much for your support. Before we move on here, I had a lot of people complaining last week that the show never pushed out to Stitcher. I still don't know if episode 430 is even on Stitcher. It may not be. It may go down as the lost episode if you're a Stitcher listener. It was nothing that I did. It was nothing I think that Podbean even had anything to do with. I checked with them right away, and they looked into it, and they said it was some sort of an issue with iTunes that's been going on for a while. Not with every podcast, obviously, but there have been a number of shows, apparently, that have had issues. It hasn't pushed out to the podcast app or to iTunes. And I know a lot of you listen to it through iTunes without any issues, so I don't think iTunes so much was the problem. But it never did pop up on Stitcher, I don't think. That's more of an iTunes or a Stitcher thing. It has nothing to do with me. Again, I push the show out, and it just goes out everywhere else it needs to be. And I will just say this, though. Stitcher has been a little wonky lately. It's actually been pissing me off. And if you're a Stitcher guy and you want to give it a shot, hopefully there's no problems this week. That's cool. But just be aware, if you ever have any issues downloading or streaming the podcast, if you're an iTunes person and it's not on iTunes, if you're a Stitcher person and it's not showing up on Stitcher, if you stream it on the Podbean site, some of you have complained that sometimes in the middle of the show it'll just reset back to the beginning. I don't know why that's happening, and neither do they, because I've asked them. But you're always able to get the show one way or another. That's part of the reason why it's so fragmented. The show is in so many different places. It's like, what our audience is, it's even higher than that. It's even higher than my numbers reflect, because the show is available in so many different places that I'm not able to track. And not all of these different places, necessarily boost our iTunes numbers, for example. So the show is available in a multitude of different ways for a reason, because if one or two ways don't work, you've got at least three or four other ones that will. And you can stream it. If you go on a website like Podbay, okay, podbay.com, I think even player.fm, if you navigate to the website, I think those sites even give you a direct download link if you would prefer to download the MP3. But you've got iTunes, you've got Stitcher, you've got TuneIn Radio, you've got player.fm, you've got Podbay, you've got Audio Boom, you've got the Podbean app, you've got our own free app in the Google Play Store if you have Android devices. One recommendation I wanted to make here, a lot of you guys rave about this app. I haven't used it, but people swear by it. Download this free app called Podcast Addict. Apparently, Podcast Addict, the people who use it, they never have any issues. As soon as the show is pushed out, boom, it's there. So that might be something you want to try out if you've never heard of it before. So just know that no matter what, even if you're having issues, you're always connected to the show. You're always hooked up. There's always a way. As they say, where there's a will, there's a way. I try to make it as easy as I can when one method fails. Like I said, there's three or four or half a dozen other ways for you to get the show, even if it's just for 1 week. And then hopefully whatever the issue is, it resolves itself, or it's a one-time freak occurrence and everything goes back to normal. But you never have to be without the sound off. There's always a way to make sure that you can have access to the show. Now, the big story, or one of them anyway, of this week, Hulk Hogan. His civil trial against Gawker over the release of his sex tape is now over, and the jury has decided that his privacy was in fact violated to the tune of $115 million. I sound like that guy in the Lotto commercial here in New York. They used to have these commercials. The guy would step up to the microphone, and he would say, "This is the New York Lotto jackpot is now..." And half the time, the Lotto jackpot wasn't even as much as what Hulk Hogan got awarded by this jury. That is above and beyond the $100 million that he sued for. He was awarded $55 million in economic injuries and $60 million for his emotional distress. Now, my question is, does Terry Bollea get the $60 million for his emotional distress, and does Hulk Hogan get the $55 million for economic injuries? How does that work? Because apparently, one thing I learned during this trial is Hulk Hogan and Terry Bollea are two different people. Now, there may yet be more damages, punitive damages, that get tacked onto that. We're going to find out tomorrow. The jury is coming back to court on Monday. And we'll see if they feel Hogan deserves more than the $115 million. He could end up with a payout even, you know, bigger than that. Gawker, for its part, they say they expected the verdict. They plan to appeal. The trial took place in a part of Florida where Hogan, I think, grew up. Or there were people on the jury from places where Hogan used to either live or that he grew up. And so they may have been sympathetic to his plight. This is what Gawker would argue. They have a very good chance of winning on appeal and getting this overturned so that Hogan doesn't see a dime of this money. This is not over yet. They have maintained all along, Gawker has, you know, First Amendment rights. They apply here. Hogan was very braggadocious about his sex life, very public about it in the past, and talked about it on Howard Stern and all these different places, and Bubba the Love Sponge. And so therefore, all Gawker was doing was just adding to that, right? They didn't violate his privacy so much as he violated, you know, he willingly violated his own privacy, and they just kind of piled on. That would be their argument. There is evidence that has since come out, and this is going to hurt Hogan, most likely, in any sort of appeal. The judge did not allow this during the trial. She did not allow the jury to hear this regarding statements that Bubba the Love Douche made about, you know, whether or not Hogan knew he was being filmed. And he made these statements under oath, okay, which is important. Bubba was under oath. He made these statements. Basically, he told the FBI that Hogan knew. He said Hogan knew. Hogan knew he was being filmed. And then later, in a separate deposition, now this was after he settled with Hogan for $5,000, and he agreed as part of the settlement not to testify against him in court. In this other deposition, Bubba said Hogan didn't know. So either way, the guy perjured himself. If there's a God in this world, he'll end up in jail. Now, there's also apparently text messages and other messages from Hogan's lawyers that were sealed. Now they're unsealed. They've been released publicly. They seem to suggest Hogan wasn't so much worried about the sex stuff getting out. He was worried because he knew he made racist comments on there. And he didn't want that getting out. So there is some very potentially damning stuff in there that could come back to bite Hogan in the ass on appeal. Very likely that he'll either end up with nothing, or whatever payout he does get, it's going to be substantially less than what he was awarded here. It's not like he walked out of the courtroom, you know, back up the Brinks truck and put the money bags in there. But however this ends up, I said this, I think, last week. I was kind of joking around about the case, and, you know, I'm happy he won. I'm happy for him. I think what happened to him was wrong. I think Gawker deserves to pay. I think it was bullshit what they did to him. And, you know, if that means bankrupting the entire company, then so be it. I don't have any sympathy for them. Now, under Florida law, I was reading up on this. There was a great article about this on CNN Money. Kind of laid out the whole potential scenario going forward. But under Florida law, Gawker is responsible for posting bond in the amount of, I think, what the damages were, as a matter of fact. But there's a cap at the amount of like $50 million. So the bond cannot exceed $50 million. So if the damages exceed $50 million, that would be the max in terms of the bond that they would have to post. Now, that in and of itself could be crippling to a company like Gawker. They don't have $50 million in the bank just sitting there. You know, and, I mean, in the same story, it mentioned that in 2014, Gawker generated $45 million in revenue. They made a profit of, I think, $6 or $7 million off of that. But they made $45 million in the year. They don't even make $50 million in a year. And they may be on the hook for posting bond in that amount even before the appeal. I guess that's going to be up to a judge. But, you know, the appellate courts, they've been sympathetic to Gawker's plight before. They've overturned some of the judge's decisions in this case that had been in favor of Hogan. So I think it's a little premature to be writing Gawker's obituary, but again, I will say that if their obituary is written when this is all said and done, if you know, Hogan's payout is reduced even by half, I think it would still probably be the end of Gawker. And so be it. You know, so be it. And from Gawker, we go to TMZ. TMZ broke the news on Thursday that Sting's in-ring career has come to an end after those buckle bombs from Seth Rollins in their match at Night of Champions. He messed up his neck real bad in that match. I mean, fact is, his neck was already messed up, and this was just the final nail in the coffin. Sources told TMZ, after meeting with several doctors, they all felt it would be too much of a risk for Sting to get back into the ring, especially at his age. He told WWE months ago, it was an interview on WWE.com, and Sting told them, you know, he was diagnosed at the time with cervical spinal stenosis. Now, cervical spinal stenosis, it's not like a sudden injury. It's not something that you get slammed and all of a sudden you have spinal stenosis. It's something that develops over time. It's a progressive narrowing of the spinal canal. It affects the nerves. It can become very painful over time. And the story says that Sting may make the official announcement of his retirement during his speech at the Hall of Fame. He is the headliner in Dallas at this year's Hall of Fame ceremony. And he is open to a non-wrestling role in WWE if WWE were to offer him one. That's what the story said. And, you know, I floated this in the column I did for SE Scoops. I did a whole column on Sting and the legacy he leaves behind and his career. It's up on SEScoops.com in the editorial section. And I said this there, you know, you could do a deal where Sting helps Shane McMahon win at WrestleMania, sort of like a callback to the storyline where Shane bought WCW back in 2001. And then Shane could make Sting the new Raw general manager the next night. The problem with that, though, is you have Sting interfere, you have him cost Undertaker the match, and not follow that up with some sort of a confrontation between Sting and The Undertaker, either the next night or at SummerSlam or WrestleMania the following year. I could see where that would be very disappointing to some people. It doesn't mean you can't do it, but it wouldn't make sense. If Sting can't wrestle, if he can't get physical, if he can't take bumps, it just doesn't make sense for The Undertaker not to get some retribution or try to get some retribution on him at some point. Or just tease people who are going to think, who don't know about this, who are going to say, oh my God, you know, Sting and The Undertaker, they're going to have a match now, and then you don't deliver. I could see where that would be underwhelming to some people. But it was the first thought that popped in my head when I heard about like a non-wrestling role on WWE programming, and it wouldn't be something, you know, you're not going to have Sting on television every week. It's the law of diminishing returns. It's like if Hogan or somebody were to come back, you know, if they're on television every single week, after a while, it's not going to mean anything. You know, look at Brock. When Brock shows up, it means something. People take notice. They sit up. Because Brock Lesnar is not on television every single week, as much as I would love for him to be. It's the right way to handle a guy like that. You know, you keep people wanting more. You save him for when you really need him. And that would be the same thing for Sting, and it would be twofold. First of all, it gets Sting on television, and it gets rid of this god-awful heel authority figure bullshit that we've been dealing with now on this show for I don't even know how many years, at least the last 3 years, probably a lot longer than that. Yeah, they have a babyface GM on NXT, William Regal. He's not necessarily on every show. He comes out when he has to, he makes an announcement, and it's fine. You know, I mean, it's okay to change things up, and I know they have this hard on you, they're going to have an authority figure, and I don't think that's ever going to go away. At least break up the monotony of things, get rid of the authority for a while, let Sting take over in some sort of babyface authority role, and show up every now and then when we need him to show up. You know, maybe that would be the best way to handle it. Again, just one idea. I'm sure people can come up with a whole bunch of different ideas. I made it pretty clear back in December on Sound Off 413, you can find the clip, it's up on TV Tracks, that I thought Sting was going into the Hall of Fame in Dallas. I mean, I wasn't the only one who was predicting that, but I said he's going into the Hall of Fame in Dallas, and I think he's wrestled his last match. I said even then, you know, months ago, I thought he was done. If for no other reason, I said that because the guy was diagnosed with this spinal stenosis, right? Spinal stenosis is what ended Steve Austin's career. It's what ended Edge's career. Edge was still in his 30s when they came to him and said, we're not letting you wrestle anymore. Okay? He was in his 30s. Sting turns 57 years old today. Happy birthday, Sting, by the way. So what I think happened, and this is just my opinion. I mean, again, the article says that doctors told Sting he shouldn't wrestle and Sting made the decision himself. Maybe he did. But I look at this and I say to myself, this guy in just a few months ago, was talking to WWE.com, and they asked him, are you going to come back? When are you going to come back? And his answer was telling. It was almost what you would expect. It was, I don't want my career to end that way. I really would rather not go out that way. And he was going to, you know, try his hardest to come back and wrestle again. That's basically what he said. So what I think happened here is WWE, you know, they know all about his medical condition. They have all the tests, I'm sure, and the x-rays and the results, and they probably talked to Sting's doctors, and they made the decision for him. I think WWE said, we're not going to let you wrestle again. You know, you're 57 years old. You've got this condition. I mean, Sting has also said he needs surgery on his neck. I don't know that he ever had neck surgery. I don't. Maybe he will after WrestleMania. It seemed very unlikely to me that WWE would force someone like Edge out of the ring and force him into retirement, but let Sting come back and wrestle another match. It just didn't make any sense to me. So I think this may be more a case of WWE, frankly, making the decision for him. And, you know, if they say we're not going to let you wrestle, then there's not a whole lot that Sting can do. You know, unless he just is so passionate about having one last match that he lets his deal run out and he goes back to TNA, if there's even a TNA to go back to. But I don't see that happening. And again, in the column I did for SE Scoops, it wasn't just talking about, his injuries and how sad it is he never really had a productive run in WWE. And it is. It's very sad that Sting never had the chance to have a real run in WWE. I think even just 5 years ago, he still would have been in his 50s, but even 5 years ago, I think you could have gotten a lot of great matches out of Sting against a lot of big names. Maybe if Sting had just come over to WWE in the first place and never gone to TNA, you know, we could have had Sting and The Undertaker. We could have had Sting and Shawn Michaels, which is another match that I kind of regret we never got to see. Sting and Randy Orton, Sting and, you know, even John Cena. I mean, he could have wrestled all of them, and I think he would have had good to great matches with all of those guys. I always thought that Kane, the original Kane, not this corporate version of Kane, but the old Demon Kane from 10, 15 years ago, would have been the perfect opponent for Sting. You know, he would have been another one. And we never got to see those matches, but in TNA, you know, he had some great matches. He had matches with Kurt Angle and AJ Styles and Samoa Joe and other people as well, but those are the ones that kind of stand out to me. Abyss, right? He had matches with Abyss. So, you know, it wasn't a completely lost cause, but I still can't help but feel, you gave your last really great years to Dixie Carter. That's loyalty. That's loyalty right there. Now, don't think it's just loyalty. Obviously, TNA was paying him very well. If TNA wasn't paying him what he was looking for, I'm sure he would have walked a long time ago. But they always managed to, you know, pull it out of their ass somehow and sign him to a new one-year extension and another one-year extension and another one-year extension. And he kept coming back and coming back and coming back. And I think the last moment where it would have been perfect for him to come in. And I don't know that they would have been able to make the match anyway because it was Triple H's match. And you're not going to fuck with Triple H's WrestleMania match. But if you remember, people were going crazy with those vignettes. They thought Sting was coming in 2011. Oh, Sting's coming in. He's going to wrestle The Undertaker at WrestleMania 27. This is awesome. And it turned out that those vignettes were for The Undertaker's return. And that was the year that Undertaker wrestled Triple H. So I'm sure those plans were probably set, you know, at least a few months in advance. But I remember hearing that, you know, there were phone calls that were made from people in WWE to Sting, or at least people in Sting's camp, I guess, to inquire about whether or not he would be interested in coming over, or if he was even available. And it was a case where either he was still under contract, or he was open to the idea, but the, you know, discussions never really went further than that. That would have been the time to do that match. And it just felt like, you know, once that came and went, it just felt like that was just a missed opportunity that they were never going to be able to get back. And as it turned out, they never were. You know, he came in, he had the WrestleMania match against Triple H. It was, you know, smoke and mirrors. Everybody in the world came in and interfered in the match, and DX came back, and the NWO came back. And to be there and watch the match live was a lot of fun. You know, you hear the NWO music hit, and out they come, and you know, it was a lot of fun. It was a spectacle. But, you know, to think that Sting's one and only WrestleMania match was a loss to Triple H, It's a tough pill to swallow. You know, I could think of worse people for him to come in and lose to, but, you know, it is what it is. They have their reasons for doing it. I talk about that in the column as well. I think Sting, at the end of the day, he's going into the Hall of Fame in a couple of weeks. Deservedly so. Absolutely, you know, more than qualified in any kind of Hall of Fame, I think, to be in there. He had a 30-year career, 31, I think, 31 years. And every step of the way, you know, from the very beginning when he first came in, even when he was doing the Blade Runner thing with, you know, Warrior, and then when Flair, you know, made him a star in one night at that Clash of the Champions show. I mean, if you look at Sting's career in WCW, he had his ups and downs. I mean, there was a period of time in the mid-90s where he was wrestling guys like Regal, I think, for the TV title. He was hardly, you know, headlining shows. But I think for the most part, if you look at his career, Sting was always a top guy. He was always at or near the top. He was always in that mix. He was, you know, very popular, obviously, with the kids and all that. And just, I think, across the board, very popular. And I'm not going to get into a whole discussion again about, was Sting a draw? I'm not even getting back into that. But he was a big, you know, he's a big star. He was the Avenger of WCW, you know, against the NWO during a period where wrestling has never and may never again be as hot as it was during that period. He was the face, you know, he was the franchise, even more than Ric Flair was at that time of WCW, and went to TNA, and he was a big star there, came into WWE, and, you know, immediately was kind of put in that position. He was a top guy. He was wrestling for the world title a few months later, and then this happened. And, you know, it's a shame, but I could think of worse ways to go out than wrestling against the champion, you know, in the main event on pay-per-view. And to his credit, Sting went out there. It wasn't like he was dragging his feet just to earn a paycheck. You know, he did a fucking plancha off the top rope in that match, and he didn't have a whole pile of 5 or 10 guys outside waiting to catch him. The only person standing there waiting to catch him was Seth Rollins. And Sting climbed up there, he dove off, he was doing all the Stinger splashes, you know, he was hanging in there. You know, he was hanging in there, and then, you know, he took the buckle bombs, and I still kind of shake my head at that, why he would take any, let alone two. It's just amazing. I mean, he took that second one, the second one is what did it, and it's like, why would you do two buckle bombs? Like, I think even in, like, any normal Seth Rollins match, he'll give somebody one buckle bomb. For some reason, they just decided that, you know, 56-year-old Sting should take two of them, and, you know, I don't know. I don't know what the thought process was there, but, you know, he refused to call the match off. He was on wobbly legs. He wanted to finish the match, and he did, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. And I think at the end of the day, Sting's career, even if it doesn't end the way that he wanted it to, he had a hell of a career. Not too many guys can say that they were as popular as he was pretty much the entire length of his career. I mean, if you really look at it from start to finish, this guy was always very popular and always at or near the top. And I think that'll be his legacy. That and his loyalty. I think spending all those years with WCW, being the one lone big name that never jumped ship and went to WWE, you know, at least so long as WCW was alive. And then the loyalty that he showed to Dixie Carter, maybe too much, quite frankly. Too much loyalty to TNA. But the guy was loyal to a fault, had a great career. Nothing to complain about there. And he'll go into the Hall of Fame in a few weeks, and I guess after that we'll see if they have any plans for him or if he's going to have neck surgery or what his future holds. But I think it would be cool to find a role for him on the show where he could at least still be involved. Because I think Sting, if he showed anything in his TNA days, especially the later years in TNA, he turned into a better talker in TNA than he ever was in WCW. I mean, the one thing that actually got better with age was his promo ability. So, like, even if he didn't like the Joker Sting character, I thought, you know, it got old after a while, but I think that was a pretty incredible transformation for a guy who had been playing one role pretty much his entire career and then just kind of, you know, went crazy and turned into this completely different character that was obviously modeled after, you know, Heath Ledger's Joker character. But I thought it was, you know, I thought it was very entertaining, and his promo ability is really what jumped out at me. So even if he can't wrestle, he can talk. And in WWE, I think that's probably more important than even working. At least it feels that way sometimes. You have to be able to talk. Sting can talk. And as long as he can talk, there's always going to be a role for him on the show. Monday Night Raw was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania this past week. 2 weeks now until WrestleMania. WWE has announced that WrestleMania is going to be 7 hours long this year. A 2-hour pre-show on USA Network, 4 hours of WrestleMania itself, and a 1-hour post-show. If you think Raw is long, you just wait. Thankfully, we're going to be on a party bus before WrestleMania doing our own pre-gaming, so we won't have to sit and watch that. This year, the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal, it has also been announced, will be airing on USA as the pre-show match. And it will only have 20 superstars instead of the usual 30, I assume because injuries. That would be my assumption. The Raw Instapoll for the show this past Monday night, 1,743 votes. 64% thumbs down, 36% thumbs up. A little harsher than I would have gone. I didn't think it was that bad, but I think the people have spoken. New Day and League of Nations. They had a match on this show that New Day won. It was actually the opening match. And it led to a prolonged beatdown. And when I say prolonged, this thing felt like it would never end. This was a long, almost uncomfortable beatdown of New Day after this match. Obviously, this was just set up to solidify the New Day face turn. Apparently, they're now baby faces in WWE. People were already cheering them, but this was, I guess, you know, intended to make it official. Byron Saxton, he made a stupid comment during this match, though. And look, I understand that they're trying to build these guys up. That's what you have to do. It just came off so bad. He's talking about the League of Nations, and he refers to the League of Nations as a dream team. Well, then maybe they ought to change their name to Lunesta, because these four put me to fucking sleep whenever I see them together on TV. And this is going to be the WrestleMania match. They're not doing a four-way. They're doing New Day defending the tag team titles, either in a traditional 2-on-2 or maybe a 3-on-3 against the League of Nations. You know, now it's babyface against heel, not heel versus heel. That's the WrestleMania match. Not the match I would have made. But I guess if their goal here is to turn New Day babyface, I guess they felt that was the best way to do it. Me, I would have maybe held off on that so I could get that four-way in at WrestleMania. Or you could do a four-way with New Day as the babyfaces. That's fine. I thought, you know, it was going to be a four-way with the Dudleys getting the belts, and then ultimately the Dudleys dropping the belts back to the Usos. But they decided to turn New Day, and they're trying to give the rub to the League of Nations. And so this is the match they made. Dean Ambrose. He came out for a promo on the show that was interrupted by Paul Heyman and Brock Lesnar. They are now that Ambrose has been vanquished by Triple H, as so many before him, they can focus on the Mania match between Ambrose and Lesnar. And by the way, there have been some rumors, unsubstantiated reports online. I don't know what websites they originated with. No websites that I've been reading about Vince McMahon changing his mind possibly on the WrestleMania main event, but not just changing his mind like maybe making Undertaker and Shane the actual, like, last match on the show. Because that I could see. I could see the Hell in a Cell match going on last. But the reports that I'm seeing are saying he's changing his mind and instead we're going to get Dean Ambrose against Brock Lesnar in the main event of WrestleMania. And, look, never say never. I'm not saying it's impossible that it absolutely can't happen. But I just laugh when I hear that. Like, in my mind, there is no chance that Dean Ambrose is going on last at WrestleMania. And if he was going to go on last at WrestleMania, he would have won the championship at Roadblock. You're not going to have Triple H defending the title against their chosen son, Roman Reigns, and a Hell in a Cell match with The Undertaker and Shane, but headline with Brock and Dean. I mean, what rational person would even believe such a thing? So if you've read the same thing and you're wondering, I don't think it's happening. Believe me, I doubt very seriously that would happen. But it is one of the matches I'm looking forward to most on the show. I'm looking more forward to Brock and Dean than I am Triple H and Roman, I can tell you that. This was kind of weird, because Ambrose was taunting Brock. Brock came down to the ring, and just before he was going to get inside, Ambrose revealed a crowbar. And Brock, you know, being the tough badass that he is, he still tried to get in the ring. And Ambrose fought him off, and Brock backed off. Because the guy had a fucking crowbar. But it's just weird to me because I can't say that they ever turned Brock heel. It's not like they ever did something dastardly with him in the last few months. People still cheer him for the most part. When he comes out, he will get booed. I mean, we've seen a couple of beatdowns on Ambrose where Brock has gotten booed. It's amazing how that works when you take a babyface people actually like and you do something terrible to him, they boo the other guy. Okay, unfortunately, that hasn't been the case with Roman Reigns. But with Ambrose a few weeks ago, they booed Brock Lesnar. So you can get the people to boo him if you want, but yet he's the one coming in like the big badass trying to take it to Dean Ambrose, and Ambrose has to resort to using a weapon, and he won't even let the guy in the ring. Now, I guess it makes sense because almost every single time we've seen a confrontation between these two, Dean Ambrose gets laid out. So if this were real and I were Dean Ambrose, I probably would do the same thing. I'd have a baseball bat or I'd have a crowbar or I'd have an AR-15 or something to keep this guy away from me. But it's just weird because we're supposed to cheer Dean and I guess boo the other guy, I guess. But anyway, so that was kind of weird. Mick Foley showed up a little later on in the show backstage. He gave Dean Ambrose a gift. Turned out to be a baseball bat wrapped in barbed wire, which the crowd reacted big to. It was fun seeing Foley here in Pittsburgh, which of course is the site of his Hell in a Cell match with The Undertaker, where he nearly killed himself. So he gave him the barbed wire bat to use at WrestleMania. He said, a crowbar is fine, but this is better. He said, a crowbar is kind of boring. This at least has some personality. By the way, Gavin on Twitter, remember last week I said, you know, Dirty Deeds is just a stupid name. I think it's a stupid name for his finish, and we should all kind of pool our minds together and try to come up with a better name. And a few of you did, you know, tweet me and email me with some names, but Gavin, I thought, had the best one. He suggested the Straight Jacket as the new name to replace Dirty Deeds, and I like it because if you envision the move, it even looks like he's putting his opponents in a straitjacket, kind of, right? You know, when he hooks their arms behind them for the move. So I think in more ways than one, that name would work. And WWE is free to steal it if they ever want to. Triple H on this show. Triple H should join the League of Nations because his promo nearly put me to sleep here. I enjoyed his rant about how people hate their bosses and they hate their lives, right? I enjoyed that promo much better when I first heard Vince McMahon give it 16 years ago. And he did a much better job with it, I might add. That was the famous Life Sucks and Then You Die speech on SmackDown. That's actually a hell of a promo. It's maybe one of the best that Vince has ever given. So if you've never heard it before, go on. I don't know if all the SmackDown shows are up on the network, but you can go on YouTube. I know the promo is up there. So Triple H is out there and with Stephanie, and he's just droning on and on and on, and really just generally making everybody in the crowd feel terrible about their lives, which is awesome, by the way. No wonder the crowd was pretty much dead for the rest of the show. They sat there contemplating their lives for the next 2 hours. But it did serve a purpose. Dolph Ziggler... No, seriously, don't laugh. Dolph Ziggler interrupted. Of course, Stephanie slapped him, because that's just what she does. She said, aside from the WWE title match, she was going to let Dolph pick any match that he wanted for WrestleMania if he could beat Triple H in a match tonight on Raw. And for a moment there, I realized they were in Pittsburgh. And I was kind of hoping, you know, Roman Reigns would come out, he would help Dolph win the match, and then afterwards, Dolph's all alone in the ring, and Kurt Angle's music hits, and we'd have a new match for WrestleMania. Place goes nuts, and we have a new match for WrestleMania, but it was not meant to be. Ziggler and Triple H, I thought they had a good match. Maybe Triple H's last match ever on Raw. It's very possible that it was. He won with a pedigree. Contrary to what I saw some people saying online, like in our Facebook group, he did not bury Dolph Ziggler. This is a great example of how the word is overused, and I know I've talked about this on the podcast before. You know, I use that word, I try to use that word very, very rarely because it is probably the most overused word when it comes to wrestling fans having debates and discussions about this sort of thing. I don't think everybody quite understands what it means. These guys had a competitive back-and-forth match, and in the more competitive, quite frankly, than it should have been. If you look at the way Dolph Ziggler has been booked, And what they've done with this guy in the last 6 months, in the last year. As far as I'm concerned, Triple H gave him more than he should have. So this was a competitive back and forth match. And in the end, the WWE champion won. You know how I feel about the world champion being beaten on TV in non-title matches. Okay, I am no fan of it. Unless it leads to an immediate championship match with that person who beat the champion. Okay, generally speaking, I fucking hate it when they do that. Dolph Ziggler is not getting a WWE title match anytime soon. So, therefore, this was the correct outcome. I had no problem with this whatsoever. It's the most meaningful match that Dolph Ziggler has had on this show in months. He was buried more by Stephanie slapping him in the face than he was anything that Triple H did to him. Now, Roman Reigns made his big return. He's been off TV for like 3 weeks now. Busted up his face, had surgery. He came back. Unfortunately for Dolph, he waited until Dolph lost his match. Then he came out. And interestingly, he walked out like a normal person out of the entranceway. So it looks like they may have... And I think he did the same thing on SmackDown, too. So it looks like they may have ditched the fan entrance for him. But he walked out, and he proceeded to get booed. Pittsburgh was not fond of the big dog, which is what they call him. I guess Pittsburgh must be another one of those damn smart cities that people love to talk about, right? A lot of smart folks there in Pittsburgh. So Roman comes out. He proceeded to beat the shit out of Triple H all over the building, beat him into the back. He broke a flat panel over his back. The Usos and Mark Henry had to calm him down. It was pretty wild stuff. Triple H got cut on his head. He needed to have his head stapled shut. They were picking glass out of his back. One of the referees got a gash on his leg. He needed 13 stitches for it. I have to say, I watched both videos. They had videos of both Triple H getting stitched up and the referee getting stitched up on their YouTube channel. And the referee video is the one where I had to turn away. It was like, I can't even watch this. It was much sicker than the Triple H video was. Like, there's a part of the video, I don't even know, like, it looked like he has this gash in his leg, right? And they're putting the needle in, I guess, to anesthetize him or whatever. But the guy grabbed part of the flesh and was, like, peeling the flesh. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, no, don't do that. I had to turn away. This is somebody, I'm a big horror movie fan. You know, all the Saw movies. I've seen a lot of sick shit. I've seen a Serbian film, okay, which scarred me for life, and I advise you never to ever watch that movie. And for some reason, this bothered me. But yeah, that WrestleMania main event is going to be quite the spectacle, especially if they decide to put that match on last. It makes sense for it to go on last. I can't see Triple H not wanting to go on last. The title's on the line. The championship should go on last, you know, traditionally, but this is not a very traditional WrestleMania. So if they decided to switch this and have the Hell in a Cell match go on last, I think that might make for a better idea. But, you know, it also depends on the outcome of the Hell in a Cell match. Depending on how that match is going to go and who's going to win or who may turn or show up, I mean, maybe it's not appropriate to end the show with that match. I don't know what they have planned just yet. So we'll see. But either way, I mean, it's going to be ugly. I mean, as Brock Lesnar once said, it's going to be ugly, people. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And they have nobody to blame but themselves. They announced Jacqueline for the Hall of Fame. Apparently she is a former Cruiserweight champion. I had absolutely no memory of this happening, but apparently she did win that title. She beat Chavo Guerrero for it. One of the greatest of all time, according to Matt Stryker. Chris Jericho and Neville had a little bit of a match. Unfortunately, Neville got hurt. He is the man that gravity finally remembered. He did a baseball slide under Jericho's legs, and in doing so, he got his boot caught in the mat and unfortunately suffered what appears to be a fractured left ankle. He will not need surgery, which is good news. He's going to be in a cast. He's going to be on crutches for about 2 to 3 months. So if all goes well, he could be back as early as mid-May. I'm thinking, you know, I could probably see him back more in like early June, would be my guess, but, you know, could be mid to late May at the earliest that we see Neville back in the ring. So, not as bad as initially feared, but still, the timing is just terrible for this guy. You know, this would have been his very first WrestleMania, and it's yet another injury. You know, it's another one to add to the scrap heap, and of all things, on a simple baseball slide. A baseball slide through Jericho's legs. This is a guy who does so many flips. He probably does a backflip into bed every single night. He doesn't count sheep, you know, the fucking guy. He counts red arrows and phoenix splashes. He did a running backflip out of the ring onto the floor in a match with Kevin Owens 2 weeks ago on Raw. He landed on his feet. I mean, he stumbled backwards a little bit, but he landed on his feet. Okay, nobody caught him. This is the kind of shit that this guy does. But on a baseball slide, he breaks an ankle. It's just, it's awful. I mean, they had video of him backstage after it happened. He was being tended to by the doctor. And Neville just flat out asked the guy, is it broken? And the doc goes, yes. And Neville, you know, his eyes told the whole story. I mean, he had more pain in those eyes than anywhere else in his entire body. It took everything for this guy not to just start crying, like break down and crying. He was already crying, but he was trying to hold back. And you just watch that, and you know, and they're asking him, do you want an ambulance? Do you want a car? He's like, no, I want a car. I mean, I would assume if you wanted an ambulance, WWE would pick up the tab for it because they cover injuries. So if a guy gets hurt on the job, if he gets hurt in the ring, they will pay for the surgery or whatever needs to be paid for. I would assume transport, you know, to the hospital in an ambulance would be covered. So maybe he just didn't want to take an ambulance, or I don't know, maybe he was worried about being billed for it. Who knows? But you just watch that and you feel really bad for the guy. And, you know, there was a big story about Charles Robinson, who was the referee for the match, not recognizing that Neville was hurt. And Jericho could tell, and he called an audible. He rolled him up, and Robinson held up on the three count, even though Neville never got his shoulder up. And Jericho lost it. He shoved the referee. He said, he's hurt. What the fuck are you doing? And he had enough sense to tell Robinson to DQ him, and he called for the bell, and they were jaw-jacking back and forth, dropping F-bombs, and, you know, it blew over. Look, shit happens. It's not like it's a huge deal. But I know the next day Robinson went on Twitter and he apologized. He said, I apologize, I used a bad word. You know, he's a good Christian man, and I used a bad word. And people were taking him to task. I was looking at some of the Twitter replies like, oh, I see WWE told you to apologize. I don't think WWE told him to do anything. I don't think they told him to apologize. I just think he did it on his own. He felt bad about it. He was probably getting tweets from people saying, hey, you know, what happened last night, and you fucked up, and this and that. And he just, you know, he said, look, I'm sorry. I said something I shouldn't have, and it'll never happen again. And, you know, it's not like WWE, you know, forces everybody to apologize for every little thing. I think he just, that's the kind of guy he is. You never hear a bad thing about Charles Robinson. He seems like a very well-liked, very well-respected figure. And I feel like he's the kind of guy where if he flies off the handle, if he loses his cool like that, you know, he'll man up and he'll apologize for it. And I think that's all this was. I thought the end of the show with Vince, Shane, and Undertaker was okay. You know, I'm still waiting for an explanation of why Undertaker is just going along with what he was told to do and doing Vince McMahon's dirty work for him. Shane called Undertaker Vince's bitch. That's exactly how he's being portrayed in this story, so that was a shoot. Undertaker went to attack him. Shane slipped out, started throwing punches. Watching Undertaker sell for this was just atrocious. Vince shoved Shane into the Undertaker, who chokeslammed him, and then Undertaker went after Vince. Vince got away, though, and that's how the show ended. And watching their offense here, I was a little less excited for the match at WrestleMania than I had been before this segment. We've got 2 weeks to go. We know Rock is going to be at WrestleMania. We still have no idea what he's doing. We know Stone Cold will have a role at WrestleMania. We still have no idea what he's doing. We know Shawn Michaels is probably going to have a role on the show. We still have no idea what he's doing. One of them, I'm guessing, will end up as the referee for the Hell in a Cell match. Of the three, I think the most likely candidate for that is Austin. Either that or they can save the show by giving us Rock, Austin, and Shawn Michaels in a three-way. That would get me excited for WrestleMania. Now, two more items here. First, we have some positive injury news for a change. Cesaro is coming back next month, April 15th. He is scheduled to make his return on the European tour in Amsterdam. Not a bad place to make a comeback. And I was thinking about this. You know, Wade Barrett is, he hasn't confirmed it, but I think by not denying the story a couple months ago that he was leaving at the end of his contract in June, he all but confirmed it. Wade Barrett is leaving in the next few months. It'd be very easy for them to have Cesaro join the League of Nations as its Swiss representative and maybe have them all kick Barrett out of the group so they can keep it a four-man group. It'd be very easy for them to do that. It would be something for Cesaro to do. I hope they don't do that, though. And not just because I'm not a fan of the League of Nations. You know, Cesaro was starting to build up some good momentum as a babyface before he got hurt. I would like to see them continue with that and just see how far the guy could go. You know, he may not be the number one babyface or even number two, but I think he could be a solid three or four. He's got the fan support. And second, one of our listeners who lives in Puerto Rico, he wrote in to tell me that down there, there's a lot of talk that Carlito has either signed or will be signing with WWE. Apparently that's the talk of the local wrestling scene down there in Puerto Rico. And we'll see what happens. You know, he is a body guy. He is a body guy now. It says so in his Twitter profile, and we all know Vince does like his body guys.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this week opened with Sami Zayn coming out for a promo. This was the segment where they made it official. William Regal came out. He announced that Sami Zayn would be facing their newest signee, one of the biggest stars in the world. And we saw a video up on the Tron, and there we saw Shinsuke Nakamura. For the very first time on NXT programming, he was somewhere. He was backstage somewhere. And the crowd reaction was very positive for Nakamura, so much so that it was so noisy I couldn't even hear what he was saying. He said something about, "See you in Dallas." That's about all I got out of that. But great reaction for him, and Sami Zayn seemed very pleased with the announcement. And it is official. It will be Sami Zayn against Shinsuke Nakamura in Nakamura's debut at NXT TakeOver Dallas. Coming up on April 1st, we have the Hype Bros beating Angelo Dawkins and Kevin Crawford with the Hype Rider. I think that's what they call it. If not, I imagine that. They should call it that. It's probably the name that they already use. But if not, that's a very cool name. So I think they should use that for their finish. Emma beat Deonna Purrazzo with the Emma Lock, the same Deonna Purrazzo who just worked a TNA taping this past week. So did Blue Pants, by the way. So easy win for Emma. Tommaso Ciampa beat Jesse Sorensen of TNA fame with his rolling armbar submission. Bayley and Asuka teamed up. This was the match they promised last week that didn't happen because the Samoa Joe-Sami Zayn match went so long. I mean, who could have expected that, right? Nobody knew. So Bayley and Asuka beat Eva Marie and Nia Jax. I got way too much pleasure out of watching Asuka kick the holy shit out of Eva. Later on, Nia accidentally dropped a big leg on Eva. Poor Eva. And then Eva got kicked in the head by Asuka from behind, right into the belly to Bayley. 1, 2, 3. Regal comes out. He makes it official for TakeOver. It will be Bayley defending her women's championship against Asuka. And next week, it's going to be Asuka versus Emma in a rematch from TakeOver London. They are promoting it as the main event. We got a backstage interview with Austin Aries. They did a little split-screen deal here with the announcers interviewing him. He did not come out before the live crowd. And I enjoyed this. I enjoyed this format. I think they should do this more often. I think they should do this on Raw more often. Aries talked about his match with Baron Corbin at TakeOver. He called himself the greatest man who ever lived. You hear that, Jesus? You were good, but you were no Austin Aries. Main event was a number one contenders match to determine who goes on to face the Revival for the Tag Team Championship at TakeOver Dallas, the Vaudevillains, or American Alpha. All you need to know about this match is that Chad Gable is fucking awesome. The guy is a beast. He has money written all over him, whether he's 5'8" or 6'8". Hopefully they realize this. He busted out Doug Williams' old move, the Chaos Theory. This is basically like a rolling German suplex, high-angle German suplex. A little bit dangerous, probably, but it looked like $1 million. Absolutely destroyed Aiden English with it. And in the end, Aiden English fell victim to the, I guess, Grand Amplitude. Is that the name of their finish? I think they're still sticking with that name. The kind of the pop-up back suplex into the bridging pin. 1, 2, 3. American Alpha now, your number one contenders. Sorry, Big Kaz and Enzo. There's a new team in town, and they will challenge the Revival for the tag team titles and hopefully win the tag team titles at TakeOver Dallas. Hopefully they will learn the lessons of what happened with Kaz and Enzo. They should have put the belts on them last summer in Brooklyn at TakeOver, and they didn't do it. And then they just lost and lost and lost, and hopefully they will not do the same with Jordan and Gable. So that's it looks like the card now for TakeOver Dallas has pretty much taken shape. We've got Austin Aries and Baron Corbin. We've got the American Alpha team against the Revival for the tag team titles. We've got Bayley and Asuka for the women's title. We've got Samoa Joe and Finn Balor for the NXT title. And we've got Sami Zayn against Shinsuke Nakamura. That is an unbelievable card. And I cannot wait. I'm telling you, I'm looking more forward to TakeOver and then the Raw after WrestleMania than I am WrestleMania itself. You know, at the end of the day, I'm sure it'll be fun, and I'm sure the stadium will be done up all nice. It'll look big, and you know, maybe Shane and Undertaker will steal the show, or you know, AJ and Jericho will steal the show, or Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens, if they let them go out there by themselves, and they can steal the show. I mean, the card has a lot of potential. It's not like the WrestleMania card looks like garbage. I think there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of questions about the main event and maybe some of the undercard. But you can't top this TakeOver Dallas card. They have stacked this thing, and who knows? You know, maybe there'll be a surprise who pops up on the show. You never know, right? That kind of leads into what I'm going to talk about now, which is TNA. I haven't had a lot of TNA news to talk about in recent weeks, and we went from no TNA news to a shit ton of TNA news. PW Insider broke some pretty big news on last night. Bobby Roode and Eric Young, two of the last remaining TNA originals, have requested and received their releases from TNA. They are gone. Eric Young, they finished up at the tapings last night, by the way. Eric Young was apparently in the middle of negotiations with them for a new deal, and instead he opted to leave. And I think that speaks volumes, by the way, that Eric Young, of all people, would decide to leave on his own, to leave TNA. He's been their biggest cheerleader. That right there should set up some alarm bells. Bobby Roode signed a one-year deal with them about a year ago. That would be running out right about now, and he decided to go a different route. Until last night at the tapings, he had been one half of the tag team champions with James Storm. And James Storm is another one. You know, he decided to take a deal with TNA a few months ago instead of staying with NXT, so I wonder what he must be thinking right about now. I mean, I know he took the better deal. He took, you know, guaranteed money from TNA. I guess they were offering more than NXT was, and you go where the money is. I'm not going to say that he made a stupid decision. Did he make the wrong decision long term? Yeah, probably he did. I don't know how long that deal was for. It was at least a year, maybe two, that he signed with TNA. But I said at the time, I said, you know, you don't want to jeopardize what you may have here with WWE. You don't know that same deal that you got before or whatever deal they may have been offering is going to be on the table 2 years from now. And James Storm is another one like a lot of these guys. He's 40 or approaching 40. He's no spring chicken. And, you know, to go back to TNA when he had this door open, this unexpected door open for him to NXT, it just seemed like a really bad move at the time. And again, money wise he may be doing better, but I wonder what's going through his head right now. You know, and Eric Young, and by the way, just to go back to James Storm for a second, he's now without a tag team partner. So Beer Money, they dropped the belt at the tapings last night. They're not the champions anymore. Where Storm goes from here, does he get a new partner? You know, hey, you know what, maybe he can hook up with Eddie Edwards. Davey Richards is going to be out a few more months. Maybe the two of them can become a makeshift team in the meantime. Eric Young, meanwhile, he had been their King of the Mountain champion, whatever the fuck that is, or at least that's what their website said. This is the same website, by the way, that still has Austin Aries listed as a member of the active TNA roster. And Mr. Anderson, too, who they fired in January. Looks like they've probably been late in paying their webmaster, too. So Eric Young did drop the King of the Mountain belt to Bram at the tapings last night, but this is a big deal. This is a bigger deal than any other person, you know, leaving TNA to go to NXT. Or this is a big deal here because these are two guys, like I said, who were two of the last. I mean, I'm thinking now, James Storm and Abyss are the only two other TNA originals that I could think of. I mean, not counting, you know, Jeremy Borash and people like that. I think Storm and Abyss may be the last two originals on that active roster. I mean, these are two guys that have been with this company since 2004. They've always been loyal. Like I said before, Eric Young in particular has always been one of their biggest cheerleaders, sometimes embarrassingly so with some of the shit that he's posted on Twitter. And now you've got Kurt Angle, Bobby Roode, Eric Young, all gone within weeks of each other. Now, They do have a solid core of young guys on that roster that they could build around. They've got EC3. They've got Drew Galloway. They've got, you know, the Wolves. They've got Mike Bennett. They've got a lot of talent there. But, you know, you start hearing things, and from what I'm hearing, things aren't looking too good for TNA right now. This may be different. I know people have written them off so many times before. You can never count out TNA. Somehow they have found a way to survive. You know, but I'm hearing things now. They've got some real problems that they're dealing with at the moment. It certainly looks like they may be shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic right about now. And as far as Rude and Eric Young are concerned, you know, where they go now, they haven't said, but I would be stunned if WWE didn't give Bobby Roode a chance. I mean, I know he's almost 40, but you know what? There's another TNA original who's almost 40, and he is absolutely killing it right now on the main roster in WWE, and his name is AJ Styles. I would think that might bode well for Roode's chances when it comes to main roster consideration. NXT, at the very least, I mean, NXT, obviously, there's a lot he can offer to NXT, but I think he, like an AJ Styles, could very easily bypass NXT and go right to the main roster. He's got a history with Austin Aries, okay, as the Dirty Heels. If they wanted to do something with him in NXT, they could put them together as a team again if they wanted to. They could always, you know, do that. I'm looking more at Roode as a good, solid main event, or not even main event, but main roster heel, which is what they really need right now. They need heels on that roster. They need some, and not the League of Nations. They need some good, credible heels. And Bobby Roode could fill that role very well, I think. Eric Young, I'm not much of an EY fan, to be honest with you. You know, whatever, he's a talented guy. And I don't just say that because he's a madman and he blocked me and he's, you know, all that kind of stuff. I just don't see him adding much value on the main roster. I mean, in NXT, I guess he could. I guess I'd be fine with him going to NXT, but am I yearning to see Eric Young on the main roster in WWE? Am I yearning to see Eric Young on Raw every week? Fuck no, I'm not. I hope he finds work. I hope, you know, he's got a plan and all that. I don't wish, you know, ill on the guy, but I'm more excited about Bobby Roode. He's a guy that I've been waiting for a while to come over to WWE, and I think it's almost like the Sting syndrome, where maybe he's been a little too loyal. Because look, Bobby Roode, remember the... Okay, I'll give this as an example. And TNA has done this multiple times. Multiple times, there have been questions about what's going to happen with their TV deal. Where are they going to end up? And they don't let the talent know. So, there was a situation, I think last year it might have been. It might have been before they made the deal with Pop. It was somewhere during that time period. There were a lot of stories and a lot of rumors. And apparently TNA was at it again. They left the talent in the dark. The talent were going to the wrestling websites to find out what the fuck was going on because nobody in TNA bothered to tell them. And Bobby Roode was one of those guys who posted like this cryptic tweet. I don't remember exactly what he said. I'm sure somebody could dig it up. But he went on Twitter and he was posting stuff about how even he didn't know what was going on. And I remember looking at that and going, Bobby Roode, maybe he wasn't like the world champion at the time, but he is a top line headline guy in TNA. He's like what Undertaker or John Cena or Randy Orton would be to WWE. That's kind of what he was to TNA. Maybe not doing the kind of business those guys were doing, but he was in that role, right? One of the TNA originals, there from day one, world champion guy, and they're not even telling him what's going on. How embarrassing is that? That, you know, these guys are going on Twitter. James Storm was another one defending TNA. I take them at their word. They told us this. But then it turns out that, you know, what TNA was telling them was bullshit. And it makes these guys look so bad. And I remember seeing Bobby Roode tweeting about this. And I'm like, what the fuck are you still doing there, dude? Get out of there. Like, you're so much better than this. Just get out of there. But, you know, look, TNA is where he made his name, and I suppose he feels a great sense of loyalty there. And again, maybe they were giving him a good money deal, and he decided to stay. Well, now it's time to make or break. And I hope that WWE has enough sense to at least give him a chance, because I think he has a lot to contribute. Even though he is an older guy, you know, he could have a nice little run for himself in WWE. And I hope that's what happens. Hopefully he doesn't just ride off into the sunset. Now, this wasn't the only big news in TNA this week. We have a new TNA World Heavyweight Champion. Drew Galloway beat Matt Hardy by cashing in his Feast or Fired briefcase to win the TNA title. Wasn't much of a match. The actual match between Galloway and Matt Hardy, it came after a three-way with Matt and Jeff and EC3. The Galloway match was only about 20 seconds. But he won the championship. This is the first time I've watched part of Impact since probably last summer, I'm guessing. It's been many, many, many months since I've sat down to watch Impact. I didn't watch the entire show. I watched, you know, part of it this week. I was not overly impressed by what I saw. But I do applaud them for giving Drew Galloway the chance to run with the championship, unless they just take it right away from him. But, you know, he's a guy, and I remember when I was still watching TNA, I even said, you know, and I thought they were building to EC3 and Drew Galloway, and I said that would be a pretty cool feud. You know, these two guys that are still relatively young, I mean, they're around 30, but they're still relatively young, both of whom were kind of fucked over, more so Galloway was just completely fucked over, and completely wasted potential on WWE's part. And they went to TNA. TNA made EC3 a star, one of the few. And they gave Galloway the opportunity to get back on TV in front of a national audience and show people what he can do. And it would be kind of cool, I thought, at that time, to put the two of them in a feud, have them fight over the world championship instead of Kurt Angle or, you know, those guys don't need to be fighting for the title. Jeff Hardy. And I don't know if they're going to do that now because EC3 now is a babyface. Galloway's a babyface. I guess one of them could turn. I still think it would be a pretty, you know, pretty cool feud for them to go to if they wanted to. But I applaud them. I actually applaud TNA for giving Galloway a chance with the belt because, let's be honest, at this point, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. They've got nothing to lose. They've got nothing to lose. They've got much bigger problems, trust me, right now than worrying about who their world champion is. So give the guy a shot. It also looks like Willow is coming back. Eric Young spotted him in a backstage segment and freaked out. Maybe not. Maybe now that Eric Young is gone, they're going to put Willow back in the forest, I guess, where he lives. But all Eric Young needs is a metal object to beat down Willow, and he'll be okay. He should know this. Maybe he can use one of those $40 Willow umbrellas on the Shop TNA website. I checked. They're still selling them. They're still selling. Actually, you know what? I should rephrase that because I doubt very seriously they're selling any of them. They're still for sale. That's the more appropriate way to put it. They are for sale. Kind of like TNA. I didn't have a chance to watch Ring of Honor this week. Hopefully next week. It's been kind of crazy. But Lucha Underground. Got to talk about this. Son of Havoc and Helico. Ibelis opened the show against Katrina's Disciples of Death for the Lucha Underground Trios Tag Team titles, with the stipulation that if Ibelis and her boys do not win the belts back, they will be banished from the temple forever. Match was shorter than I thought it would be, but still good. You know, buckle bomb by Angelico to the Purple Death dude. Followed up by a shooting star press by Son of Havoc for the win, so we have new Trios Tag Team champions. We had Rey Mysterio, who I'm starting to think is really just Master Splinter under a mask. He offered Dragon Azteca Jr. a shot of tequila in celebration of him finishing his training. He is ready. That's what Ray said. He informs Dragon Azteca that next week he will get to be part of Aztec Warfare. But he's not going alone because Mysterio himself will be part of Aztec Warfare. So that'll be Mysterio's first match inside the temple. We had Tejano beating Chavo Guerrero Jr., one of the greatest men that ever lived, according to Matt Stryker. Even greater than Jesus and Austin Aries. He beat him in a bull rope match with a sit-out powerbomb. I thought this was boring. I'm just not that into Tejano. I mean, I know he's one of the big stars down there in AAA, but I'm just not seeing the appeal. Yeah, maybe I just haven't seen enough of him. Maybe his heel work in AAA is or was... far better. I don't even know if he's a heel or a face now, but yeah, or maybe he just hasn't been focused on enough. We haven't been given enough of a reason to care about him on this show. You know, this show goes to great lengths to give us the character backstories and really make us care about some of these people. They really haven't done that much with Tejano yet, so maybe in time I'll warm up to the guy, but right now I'm just not feeling it. Backstage, Mil Muertes killed the Purple Death guy for losing their trios match earlier, which seems a bit harsh. Meanwhile, we finally get Dario fucking Cueto back on my TV screen. Took long enough. But really, he's back on my iPhone screen, which is how I watch Lucha Underground every week. It's only 4 inches, but it does the trick. The phone, that is. We have not seen nearly enough Dario Cueto this season. Hopefully that will change soon, however many episodes there are that are left. He and Black Lotus are still 375 miles away. They're listening to Matanza kill those dudes inside the warehouse. I feel like Matanza's been killing these guys for weeks. Right? It feels like... I know they just keep going back. Like, you gotta understand how this whole timeline works. But it feels like they've just been standing there for about 3 weeks now, or 4 weeks, just waiting for him to get finished murdering these dudes, and they've just been in there screaming for the last 4 weeks. So he finally is done. Dario says he's ready. He unlocks the door, and we finally get to see Matanza for the very first time. And I'm not going to lie, my first thought, and I think it's just his build. It's the guy's build. But my first thought was, if you put the glittery helmet on his head, it's the Shockmaster. That's who he reminded me of. But then I looked at him, and he's got blood all over him, and the creepy music in the background, and the guy is just fucking gigantic. You know, not like tall, but just built. Like Rusev, right? Rusev is a thick guy. This guy's even bigger than him. Now I look at him, and he reminds me of Bane from Batman. I had to look this guy up to find out who's playing him. His name is Jeff Cobb. That's the name of the guy playing Matanza. He was born in the States, but apparently he's of Guamanian descent. He was an amateur wrestler. He represented Guam in the Summer Olympics. So if he can work, I mean, if this guy can work, this guy's going to be your next champion. I guess even if he can't work, he's probably going to be the next champion. It's no wonder they changed the title to a babyface in the main event here on the show. Although, I would love to see a match between Matanza and Mil Muertes. That's the match that I really want to see. Main event was the aforementioned Mil Muertes defending his Lucha Underground Championship against the Gift of the Gods title holder, Phoenix. These two guys work so well together, I could watch them all day long. Again, Mil tears. He did this in the first match that they had. He tears away at Phoenix's mask. He rips it during the match. Phoenix also bleeds a gusher, just like he did in their Grave Consequences match. This time, though, Phoenix, later on, he gets the upper hand. He starts ripping at Mil's mask, and he's ripping and he's tearing, and he exposes the top of Mil Muertes' head for the very first time. We see that Mil actually has hair. I didn't know that. Well, I guess I did know that, but the character. I mean, I know, you know, I've seen him in, I guess, AAA, and he's got hair. But here on the show, we've never seen him before with hair on his head, so he looked a little weird. I just thought this match, it was just an outstanding brawl. I mean, there's far too many spots for me to recap. I'm not going to go move for move. I mean, but this was just so awesome. It ended with Mil going for his flatliner finish. Phoenix countered it into a wacky pinning cradle for the win. Phoenix is your new Lucha Underground champion, your third Lucha Underground champion. Prince Puma, Mil Muertes, and now Phoenix. Just a great, great match. Like I said, I could watch these two all day long. Katrina gets on the mic. She tells Phoenix his reign will be short-lived because Aztec Warfare next week will now be for the Lucha Underground title. And Phoenix will enter at number 1. Mil Muertes, meanwhile, will enter last at number 20. I can't fucking wait for that match next week. See, the first Aztec Warfare is one of the greatest matches they've ever done. I don't know if I'd say number 1. It's got to be top 3 of any Lucha Underground match between the two seasons so far. So we know that the potential is there for this match just on its own to just be fucking great and deliver. But here, what I love about it is we've got multiple stories going into it. You have Phoenix and Mil Muertes, right, entering at number 1 and number 20. You have Rey Mysterio and Dragon Azteca Jr. making their debuts. Probably both, you know, Rey's teasing he might want to take him out of the match. So you got that going on. You've got Johnny Mundo and Prince Puma. I forgot to mention them earlier. Mundo was teasing Puma. Puma was minding his own business backstage, and Mundo was teasing him and saying, I'm going to win Aztec Warfare. And so you've got something going on there between the two of them. they've got a history together. They had that All Night Long match last season, the Iron Man match. And also, you've got the question of Matanza. How does Matanza fit into all this? You know he's on his way back to the temple with Dario. So we've got lots of stories. We've got lots of intriguing possibilities. Royal Rumble rules. And the title is on the line. Do you realize what this means? Do you realize what this is shaping up to be? It means we're getting a Lucha version of the 1992 Royal Rumble this week. This is going to be awesome. No wonder I can't wait to see this fucking match. Anyway. Mailbag time. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I've had people ask me also about MP3 questions, whatever happened to them. You're still free to submit them. If you want to submit an MP3 audio question, I would ask that you keep it to 30 seconds or less, or else I'm probably not going to use it. But if you want to attach it and email it to me, I will consider using it here on the show. It's not like that ever really ended. I just didn't promote it, and people stopped sending them. So if you want to submit one, by all means, go ahead. The one thing I would ask you, besides keeping it to 30 seconds, is also include your question in text form in the body of the email. Someone asked me a question on Twitter about something Honky Tonk Man said about Rick Rude's death, a story that he told. And I said that I had heard the story, and he's not the only wrestler who's heard the same story. It was apparently talked about quite a bit back when Rude died in 99, I think it was. So I had a bunch of you know, who naturally were very curious, and you asked me to talk about it, share the story here on the podcast. I don't really feel comfortable getting into the details, only because it is still just a rumor. It's never been substantiated. His official cause of death was listed as heart failure. He overdosed by mixing medications. If the story is true, it's obviously something the family went to great lengths to make sure people, you know, didn't find out about. But since Honky Tonk Man and Jake Roberts as well are both now publicly on the record as having commented about it, you know, Jake got asked about what Honky Tonk Man said, and Jake said that he heard the same story back in the day, but he couldn't verify it. If you're interested, just go on YouTube, type in Honky Tonk Man Rick Rude. It'll be the first video that comes up. Just keep in mind, I don't know that Honky has all of his details straight. You know, when he talks about it being a suicide and all that kind of stuff, I don't know about that. But the gist of what he's saying is basically the story that other wrestlers back then were talking about kind of behind the scenes. So make of that what you will. You know, had one person who asked me, you know, could this be the reason why Rick Rude is not in the WWE Hall of Fame right now? Like they're worried the so-called real story might come out. I don't think it has anything at all to do with Rick Rude not being in the Hall of Fame. I do think he'll get in one day, and deservedly so. He should already be in the Hall of Fame. Juan from the Bronx. Could a Shield reunion during WrestleMania help Roman Reigns? The referee gets knocked out. Triple H calls out the League of Nations to jump Roman. Dean Ambrose runs down and tries to help. And then at the end, Seth Rollins comes out, turns on Triple H, and helps Roman. The show then ends with all three doing the old Shield hand gesture. I don't see the fans booing a Shield reunion, and this may help cancel out some of the heat that Roman will get that night for winning. League of Nations. League of Nations. In a WrestleMania main event. No. Keep them far away. If anything, it would be the Wyatt family. Especially, you know, after Bray said he sold his soul to the devil at Roadblock when Luke Harper wrestled Brock in his place. It's not like they're busy that night anyway. Thing about the Shield, though, is there is going to be a Shield reunion one day. In fact, I think we're probably going to get a Shield reunion at some point before this year is over. But if Seth Rollins is not ready to come back in April, I just don't see the point. You know, if he can't work a match for at least another month, if he can't take bumps, I wouldn't bring him back. And really, I mean, what's his rationale for turning on the Authority? You know, Triple H, it's not like he's been bad-mouthing him on TV. They haven't really been doing too much to plant the seeds. He's got a ready-made story when he comes back, and they can turn him, you know, baby-faced at that point. I wouldn't want to fuck up Seth's story just to get people to like Roman Reigns. I don't want to do that. I mean, I love the idea of the Shield back together doing their little hand gesture as Mania goes off the air, but it just wouldn't make any sense for it to just happen. You've got to build to it. And you still have Roman Reigns as the champion coming out of WrestleMania. It doesn't change that. It's not like, well, the Shield is now kind of back together. I mean, they could still do their own thing, but they're aligned once again, and so now everybody loves Roman Reigns. That's not how this game works. You still have the Roman problem with him as champion and getting booed and all of that stuff. Ambrose and Rollins, here's another thing, okay? Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins are two potential opponents for Roman Reigns. Why would you reunite the Shield if you're only going to break them up again a few months later? I mean, I would still love to see Roman turn either at Mania or a few months after Mania when Rollins is ready to finally come back, because I think that could be good. I think Roman Reigns in the heel role and Seth Rollins in the babyface role, even if he comes back initially as the villain and then he realizes that Triple H no longer has his back and then they do the turn, now you've got them in the right roles. And I think a babyface Rollins against a heel Reigns, that's something I think the fans could get behind. Alita from Birmingham, Alabama, with the WWE Hall of Fame quickly approaching. What are your thoughts of a Ted Turner induction with Vince McMahon inducting him? No one gave Vince more hell in the late 90s than WCW did, and I think it would be fitting to add Ted Turner into the Hall at some point. What are your thoughts? Well, it's not going to happen this year, but I agree. I think it would be a great idea. It's not like Vince hasn't made up with people before who burned bridges with him. I mean, Jeff Jarrett is one of the few that comes to mind, that, and I guess Randy Savage. But if he can let some of that go, because it's been long enough, I think having Ted Turner inducted into the Hall of Fame would be a great idea, and I think he deserves it. I mean, Ted Turner, look at it this way. Without Ted Turner's support, there is no Monday Night War. That whole prosperous period, Nitro, everything, it was because he allowed it to happen. Now, at some point during that war, the whole AOL Time Warner thing happened and Turner lost power. I mean, by the time WCW died, Ted Turner had long been out of the picture. But it was Ted Turner's support that kept WCW largely afloat. There was at least one period, if you go back into even, I think, the early 90s, where, you know, WCW very easily could have gone under, and there were a lot of people, probably working for Turner who were not fond of WCW. But Turner had a sense of loyalty to pro wrestling because pro wrestling is what put his superstation on the map. And he knew that. And it was only because of his loyalty, I guess, to wrestling or to the brand or whatever, that kept it alive. And then when Bischoff went to him and pitched the idea, you know, what's it going to take to compete with Vince McMahon? That's what Turner asked him, and Bischoff said, well, you know, if you can go head-to-head with them on Monday nights, that would be nice. And, you know, Ted Turner snapped his fingers, and boom, Nitro was born. So if you really look at the impact that he had, again, maybe he wasn't involved in the day-to-day or the creative, or I don't even know if he went. He may have been to one WCW show his entire fucking life. Okay, I don't know, but he's as deserving as anybody is for an induction into the Hall of Fame. And Vince, I think, would be the appropriate person to put him in there. And that visual of Vince McMahon on stage shaking hands with Ted Turner would probably be the one thing that would trump the visual of Vince shaking hands and hugging Eric Bischoff on Raw. That would be a surreal moment. And you know, it could get them some press, too. Ted Turner, you don't hear too much about him now. He had a pretty big role in media, and you don't really hear about him now. He kind of rode off into the sunset, and he's on his farm or wherever he is, and I don't even know if he would want to do it. Maybe he just wouldn't want to have anything to do with it, but I think at least make the offer, and if you can make it happen, you might even be able to get some good press out of it. Mike from the Bronx, I remember when Warrior first pitched his idea for an award honoring people whose work goes beyond the ring. However, I can't help but think with no ideal candidate this year that Kevin Dunn will be the first off-screen inductee. Do you think this is a possibility, and also do you think he deserves it? Well, let me talk about the Warrior Award first, because from what I read or from what I'm hearing, it looks like they won Joan London for the Warrior Award this year. Joan London was a very popular broadcaster. She was on Raw, actually, I think late last year. She's waging a very public war right now with breast cancer, and so I think for her courage in the face of what she's going through, they want to induct her and give her the Warrior Award. I don't know if she'll accept. I don't know if that's going to happen, but that's the rumor that I heard and I read. It might have been in The Observer. I don't remember. My problem with it is this, and people have talked about this before. This is absolutely not what the Warrior had in mind. So they call it the Warrior Award. Here's the thing about Warrior, okay? When he pitched the idea in his Hall of Fame speech, it wasn't even like he wanted it called the Warrior Award. His idea was to call it the Jimmy Miranda Award. Jimmy Miranda was somebody who worked, I think, in merchandising behind the scenes for WWE, one of the unsung heroes. The boys, I guess, the wrestlers were aware of who he was because merchandise is very important to them, and he was a key person in the machine who nobody talked about and nobody knew, and that was the idea behind what Warrior had in mind. You call it the Jimmy Miranda Award, and you award it to people who work behind the scenes, the so-called unsung heroes that don't get any recognition, at least not publicly. So when they gave the award to Conor the Crusher, I mean, you know, who's going to trash that? I mean, are you really going to bitch too much and protest too much that they decided to give an award to a kid that had cancer? I mean, it is what it is. It's fine. It was a nice thing that they did, but it absolutely betrays what the Warrior had intended the award to be. Like I said, he didn't even want it named after himself. So it's turned into something completely different. That's just how it's going to be going forward. I don't think Kevin Dunn is getting it. Not this year. Would I have a problem if Kevin Dunn were to get the Warrior Award? No. And I'll tell you why. Because that would be closer to what the Warrior had intended the award to be in the first place. Kevin Dunn is somebody that we know his name. He isn't necessarily an unsung hero. I think people know who he is, and he gets, you know, quite a bit of recognition from people, but not necessarily positive either. But nonetheless, I mean, he has worked for that company for, I mean, it's been well over 30 years at this point. And you could say a lot of negative things about the guy, and people who have worked in the company that have left have said negative things about him, and he's not the nicest guy in the world, and he's in Vince's ear, and all these, and the war, you know, that's brewing between him and Triple H, kind of the different factions within the company, and that goddamn shaky cam. There's a lot of negative things we could say about Kevin Dunn, but if at any point in the last 30 years or 35 years you have praised WWE for its great production values and anything even remotely like that, Kevin Dunn deserves some of the credit for that, because he's the guy who's overseeing the production of WrestleMania and all these shows, and he's been in the trenches, he's been, you know, in that truck working for them now for all these years. And there's a lot of people who work with him and for him who put the video packages together. Those are the guys you don't hear about. Those guys also deserve recognition. But just because Kevin Dunn, you don't like him, or, you know, you think he looks ridiculous, or he's playing politics, or whatever the case may be, the fact is he's put a lot of work in that company. He deserves a lot of credit for overseeing the production as long as he has. And it's a hell of a lot closer to the heart of what the Warrior had intended that award to be. So I don't necessarily like the guy based on all the things I've heard about him, but I'd be okay with him getting the award only because it makes sense. He's the kind of person that the Warrior, I think, was talking about. So yeah, I would not have a problem with him getting the award if they wanted to give it to him. And look, you got to take the good with the bad with people. It's not like this guy's an evil comic book villain who does only bad things in WWE. Maybe he's overstayed his welcome, but again, he's been there all these years. If you remember when you were a kid, Kevin Dunn was working for the company at that point. He was the one who was producing the show. And again, if at any point you heap praise on WWE for its great production and production values and all that kind of stuff, what you're doing is you're also praising Kevin Dunn. So how can you say the guy doesn't deserve to be recognized? You know, he's probably one of the most important backstage figures in the entire company. Aiden from Ireland. I've often heard you comment on how the pop from the crowd when Steve Austin ran in on the Rock vs. Mankind match is the biggest crowd pop in WWE history. But what, in your opinion, is the biggest or most heel heat you've ever seen a wrestler receive? In WWE? Probably Vicky Guerrero. Every week she would walk out on TV. The woman was a nuclear heat magnet. Otherwise, if, you know, take Vicky and put her on the side if we're not going to go with her. And I'm only half joking when I say Vicky. I mean, she would walk out there and you couldn't even hear the announcers sometimes when they were talking. That's how loud and visceral a negative reaction that she would receive. Otherwise, I think you'd have to go with Roddy Piper in 84 when he broke the record over Albano's head. You've got Shawn Michaels in Montreal. I'm talking about like singular moments now. Shawn Michaels in Montreal when he had that little heel run in 05 with the feud with Hogan. Or John Cena in Chicago, Money in the Bank 2011 against CM Punk. Go back and listen to the crowd. Punk is sitting in the ring, Indian style, and he's waiting for Cena to come out. And they're chanting, CM Punk, CM Punk, CM Punk, and it kind of dies down. And they hit Cena's music. Listen to the boos from that crowd as soon as those goddamn trumpets started to play. It's like, holy crap. I mean, I know he got booed out of Hammerstein against RVD. He was like walking into the lion's den that night. But you had maybe 2,500 people in the building that night. Here, you had 15,000, all booing in unison. It was quite the sight. I'd probably go with that or Sean in Montreal. Now, again, we're only talking WWE here. Okay, if you include the NWA, when the Horsemen formed and beat down Dusty Rhodes inside the cage, if you include Mid-South, when the Freebirds blinded the Junkyard Dog, if you include World Class, when the Freebirds turned on the Von Erichs. See, that's why the Freebirds are going into the Hall of Fame this year. Those guys knew how to get heel heat. If you open that list up to all promotions, truth be told, WWE doesn't really have shit on any of them in terms of, like, real, genuine heel heat. Tim from, I don't know where Tim is from because he doesn't say, what do you think about Vince Russo's YouTube channel taking shots at you? That's fine. I don't really care. I had another person, I think Jeremy on Facebook, sent me a message about this also. It doesn't bother me. It's fine. David from Tempe, Arizona. The pedigree. One of the first finishing moves I loved as a fan growing up, when me and my brother would do finishers on each other, I was most of the time on the receiving end of the pedigree. I kept my arms up, and that's how I was taught watching TV to take the move. That being said, when did the move change to its current way, with wrestlers usually putting their hands down to avoid concussions? I don't know it's so much about putting their hands down. They put their knee down to kind of cushion the blow. I first started seeing people do that, I think, I want to say it's back in like 2002. I think Kane was the first person I ever saw take the pedigree and put their knee down instead of just taking it face first. I'm sure somebody must have done it before him, but it goes back a long way. It goes back to like at least 2002. And that's when I first started seeing people do that. And it looks terrible. I mean, it looks like absolute shit when people do that on TV. But I mean, if I'm in their position and I'm taking a move like that, your arms, right? You always want your arms to be available to you to break your fall. I think it's just natural human instinct. If you're falling, especially face first, you want to cushion or break your fall by putting your hands out. So if you got your arms hooked back behind you and this person is driving you down face first into the floor, I could understand somebody putting their knee down to block the fall or their hand wanting to put their hands down. If that were me, I'd probably do the same thing. All I'm saying is it looks like shit when people do that. We just saw it on Monday night. Dolph Ziggler, he did that in the match with Triple H. He put his knee down. It looked like crap. But that's how people, I don't know if they're told now to take the move that way or just instinctively that's what they do to protect themselves. All I know is when Triple H used to do the move the quote-unquote normal way, okay, back in the 90s and 2000, and they just took a flat bump, flat right on their face, it's not like guys were coming up with bloody noses and broken noses. I think Triple H was a professional enough where he was taking care of these guys, and just at some point that just changed. I don't know if people got scared or Triple H did hurt somebody, and then at that point things changed. I don't know exactly what happened. But it is interesting that you mentioned putting the hands down to prevent concussions. I think of it more in terms of, you know, these guys don't want to bust up their noses. But, you know, you make a good point. I mean, if they're being driven face first into the mat, their forehead hits the mat, they're not protecting themselves. I could see where somebody could get concussed on a move like that. So maybe that has something to do with it. But it goes back to at least 2002. Eric from Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania. I feel I haven't heard a single piece of news regarding Global Force Wrestling in a while. Is the lack of a TV deal, the only thing holding them back? Can you shed any light on what's going on with GFW? Well, I haven't heard much of anything either, so I checked around, and I see that at the beginning of the month, they announced that they are partnering with the company that produces American Ninja Warrior to reformat the GFW show, which is interesting because none of us have even seen a single episode of a GFW show so far. All of a sudden, they're reformatting the show. This is what the announcement says. This is what I was able to find. They're teaming to, quote, obliterate the conventions of televised wrestling. That's their goal. They want to reinvent wrestling. Yeah, it's called Lucha Underground. Somebody should let Jeff Jarrett know. So anyway, basically, there's still nothing new to report. That's kind of the short of it. There's nothing new to report. They can reimagine their format all day long, but if they have no TV deal, they're not going anywhere. I mean, I think they have a couple of international deals. I think they have a TV deal like in New Zealand. Okay, you know, good. Here's my golf clap. Good for them, but there's nothing in the U.S. Okay, maybe teaming with a production company like this can be a good thing for them as far as making connections and opening doors and that sort of thing. I hope so. Otherwise, it seems like a lot of work for nothing with GFW. I mean, how long has it been since Jeff Jarrett first started making announcements about this thing? It's got to be at least a year. It has to be. It's got to be over a year. Remember they were announcing partners every single week. They were announcing partnership after partnership with all these different promotions, AAA and New Japan. They had, I think, 3 TV tapings, God knows how many months ago. I don't know that they've actually aired anywhere yet, but they taped TV. It reminds me of that, what the hell was that thing called? The Jeff Katz thing. Jeff Katz is like a producer in Hollywood. He's been part of movies. He's a wrestling fan. He was starting like a wrestling show, Wrestling Revolution Project. He started this Wrestling Revolution Project, and boy, that went somewhere, didn't it? Guy raised 6 figures from people on Kickstarter to start a wrestling show, brought in all these names, he taped some stuff, and then nothing. Not a damn thing. I doubt the people who donated ever got their money back either. Tay from DC. Buy or sell? Chris Jericho's world title reign in 2002, or Rey Mysterio's world title reign in 2006? I'm going to buy on Jericho in 2002 and sell on Rey in 06. Rey's run in 06 was a complete waste. Absolutely. It was so obvious that Vince McMahon did not want this guy to be the world champion. They did the story because Eddie died. They put the belt on Rey. I think Rey proceeded to get jobbed out on TV every week to, like, the great Khali and, oh, God. And then he lost the belt, I think in May. So he only held it for, like, 2 months. It was a complete waste. An absolute waste. Chris Jericho, at least, he got a WrestleMania main event out of it. I mean, his reign was also very uneventful. He did get a win at the Royal Rumble. Actually, not only did he beat Austin and Rock in the same night, he then turned around and he beat them in separate matches on back-to-back pay-per-views. Then he lost the title to Triple H. But you know what? He got to beat Rock and Austin multiple times, which not too many guys have done. And he got a WrestleMania main event out of it. That's more than CM Punk can say. David from Newark, New Jersey. Buy or sell on the better Mick Foley match, the Mind Games match with Shawn Michaels in 1996, or the street fight with Triple H at the 2000 Royal Rumble? Well, those are two of my favorite matches. I've got to buy on the Mind Games match and sell on the Rumble because I just think as a match, the Mind Games match was better. They're two very different matches. They were both brawls in a way, but obviously the match with Shawn was a little more technical. I think part of it is we saw a side of Foley, and I think Foley would probably say the same thing, that was maybe his best match. I think we saw a side of him in that match that we've never seen before. At least we didn't see that of the Mankind character, where he can actually go. Like, he's not just a brawler, he can actually wrestle, and he can go tit for tat with a guy like Shawn Michaels. And it made for a great match. And then they built in the spots where they go through the table and they, you know, the chair gets involved. I mean, the finish was terrible. It was a shitty finish with Vader being late on the run-in and the ref called for the DQ. I mean, the post-match was pretty cool with The Undertaker popping up out of that casket. Place was going nuts. But I just think overall as a match, Mind Games match was better. The Rumble match was a better brawl. That insane bump that Foley took face first pedigree on the thumbtacks. We were just talking about the pedigree. You know, there's a pedigree that I wish Mick Foley would have put a knee down for. And I think Vince chewed him out for it backstage. Like, you could have gone blind. What were you thinking? Don't ever do that again. You know, I could see where, you know, Vince would freak out about something like that. It's a crazy match. But I think the Mind Games match was a little bit better. This week's sad tweet is brought to you by Dixie Carter at TNA Dixie. Been a while since we've had a TNA sad tweet. We might have a few of them now that Eric Young is out of TNA. So, but anyway, that's a positive, though. We don't have as many as we used to. Dixie tried to send her well wishes to Sting after the TMZ report that he is retiring from the ring. Unfortunately, Sting never got those well wishes because somehow, and I still can't figure out how she made this mistake. I've tagged the wrong person in tweets a handful of times, but usually it's two people that have similar names. Instead of tagging at Sting, which is pretty simple, doesn't get much simpler than that, instead she tagged someone with the handle at NSR50 and said, "Hard to imagine at NSR50 retiring from the ring. You are one of the very best, Steve. Grateful for you and all the wonderful things we did together." This person at NSR50, who I don't think has tweeted about it, and even if he did, I wouldn't be able to understand him because he apparently lives in Japan. His entire Twitter, I keep saying his, it could be a her, but his entire Twitter is in Japanese. So unless Sting has retired to Japan and opened up his own ramen restaurant, I don't think it's him. Even EC3 made fun of Dixie. He tweeted, "I didn't beat at NSR50, which is true, he didn't. But it's the thought that counts, right? That's the most important thing.
I'm sure one of your best matches up there is another match with me and Sting at Nitro. For sure, that's got to be in your top 15 matches.
Of course, I just watched that the other day again.
And that match doesn't exist without the preparation and without Sting and I working together a couple times.
We are counting down the 15 best matches in WCW history, one match per week for 15 straight weeks, leading up to the anniversary of the final Nitro, which is next weekend. Can you believe it? We're almost there. Only two more matches left. That clip you heard there, by the way, was from the Match Anatomy segment I did as part of the countdown, this very countdown here with Diamond Dallas Page back on episode 416. When he talked about his Halloween Havoc match with Bill Goldberg, he brought up the match with Sting on Nitro, which was, in fact, a match I planned to cover here on this list. So maybe somebody can tweet at RealDDP now and tell him it's finally here. We're talking about it this week. Let him know. This is match number 14 of 15 from WCW Monday Nitro, April 26, 1999, at the Fargo Dome in Fargo, North Dakota. I didn't plan it this way, but yes, the same week we learned that Sting's career has come to an end, we've got one of his best matches here in this countdown. It is Sting challenging Diamond Dallas Page for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship. You can find the match on the WWE Network in the Nitro section. It was also on the very best of WCW Monday Nitro DVD that they put out a few years ago. This is the fifth Sting match in this countdown. And the third one for DDP, and it's also the fifth world title win for Sting. DDP had won the championship, his first WCW title, only 2 weeks before this at Spring Stampede, in a four-way against Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair, and Sting, with Randy Savage as the guest referee. And then DDP ended up turning heel on Nitro the very next night. People had grown tired of the whole people's champ shtick, and Page beat Goldberg with a pair of brass knucks and attacked him after the match with a chair to solidify the turn. So we come to Nitro here, and the match with Sting and DDP, it wasn't even the main event of the show. It headlined the start of hour number two here on this three-hour show. This was during Nitro's three-hour phase, which I'm pretty sure went the entire rest of the year. I think they went back to 2 hours at the beginning of 2000, but I could be wrong. They obviously timed this match to coincide with Raw going on the air that night. There would be a reason for this, the fact that this was not the main event on the show. It would become clear later on. We'll get to that. I thought the match itself was great. The fans were super into it. It sounded like they had 20 or 30,000 people in there. And I was very surprised to read that it was only 11,000. They had 11,000 in the Fargo Dome, but they were a loud 11,000. Toward the end of this thing, Sting went for a pile driver on Page, but he fell to his knees instead. So basically like a tombstone, but he had Page facing outward in position for like a standard pile driver. It resembled more of a Ganzo bomb. It reminded me of a spot in the Ultimate Warrior Rick Rude match at SummerSlam 89. I've seen that match enough times to, I don't know that I have every spot memorized, but that's my favorite of the matches that they had in WWE. I don't know if Rude was trying to go for a power bomb or what he was attempting in that match, but he ended up just, he had the Warrior up, he kind of fell to his knees, dropped Warrior on the back of his head. That's what this was, except Sting dropped Page on his head, only for a two count. Then came what I thought was just the sequence of the match. Place went nuts for this. Sting picks Page up for a proper tombstone pile driver. And Page reverses it into his own tombstone. Sting immediately reverses that into a tombstone, and this time he nails it. And I watched this, and I always wondered why we never got that sequence in an Undertaker match or WrestleMania. I mean, unless he did it, and I'm just totally blanking on this, you know, I'm not talking about like one guy reversing the tombstone into another one. I mean the double reversal spot where Undertaker has him up, guy reverses it, Undertaker reverses the guy, and then drops him for the tombstone. The only time I ever remember Undertaker working that into one of his matches, it was an In Your House match against Steve Austin. It was in 97. And it got such a great reaction. It just looks fucking cool, right? As long as you can muscle the guy up, it looks like a relatively easy thing to do. I mean, that's easy for me to say, I guess. You got, you know, two 300-pound guys in there. But it's not overly complicated. It's just a double reversal spot. And I always thought that would make for a hell of a finish to an Undertaker match or WrestleMania. I don't expect him to try that with Shane McMahon this year. Okay? I don't expect Shane McMahon to reverse the Undertaker into position for a tombstone. I would not count on seeing that spot in their match. But again, though, Sting only gets a two count. Great near fall. People are just losing their minds. Sting and Page get locked in a backslide. Page gives Sting a low blow from behind. The referee didn't see it. Gets Sting in the corner. He goes for the diamond cutter. He hooks his head for the diamond cutter, but Sting hooks the top rope. Doesn't go. Page tries again. And again, Sting hooks the top rope. Doesn't go. And instead, he hooks Page's head for the Scorpion Death Drop, and boom, down he goes. Crowd explodes. Sting goes for the cover, gets the three. Sting is the new WCW World Heavyweight Champion. DDP's first reign comes to an end after just 2 weeks. I cannot emphasize enough how lively this crowd was for this match. I can't speak for the entirety of the show, because I only saw part of it, but this was just so much fun to watch. It was just a really good match, but the atmosphere just made it that much better. And if you only watch this match, if this is the only match that you watched of WCW, let's say, from this show, you would never know that WCW was on its way down the tubes. This looked like the number one promotion in the world. But we still had 2 hours left to go. So let me set the stage for you here, okay? Because this is just amazing what was going on in WCW at the time. This was around the time that Ric Flair was committed to a mental institution, which is probably where the people who booked this show should have been sent. And so with Flair in the Nut House, Charles Robinson, okay, yes, referee Charles Robinson, Lil Nate, was appointed the vice president of WCW. He was put in charge of booking this show in storyline. Although it wouldn't shock me to find out that it was a shoot, and he actually did book the show. But here's the thing, okay? So Roddy Piper, who's also on the show, and I guess there must have been a power struggle going on at the time, Roddy Piper thinks he's in charge. So Ric Flair finds out about this. He calls Robinson up on the phone, from the mental asylum, mind you, to tell him that he's not happy about Piper having power, and he wants Lil Nate to call in the National Guard to deal with this problem. He says this while yelling at the other patients for touching his robe. Now, later in the show, Charles Robinson has Piper arrested, and he fires him from WCW. Okay, so you got all that? Kevin Nash decides that he wants a four-way main event tonight with himself, Goldberg, DDP, and Sting for Sting's newly won WCW World title. Flair calls up Lil Nate. I don't know how many phone calls you're entitled to when you're in the mental hospital, but this was at least the second one. He calls Robinson up on the phone. He tells him, make the match. I just love the idea that Ric Flair is watching Nitro from a mental asylum. I feel like this show, especially at that time, would legitimately be the programming of choice in such a place. You'd have to be a mental patient to watch this show. So later on, they do another skit from the mental hospital, and we see Scott Hall. Scott Hall just shows up. He's wearing a gown like he's one of the patients. I don't think he had been on WCW television in months. I don't think anybody had really heard from him. He just shows up as one of the patients. This is never mentioned. This is never brought up again. So this all leads to the four-way main event. Randy Savage gets involved. He gives DDP the assist. He tosses him a pair of brass knucks. He uses them on Nash. He gets the pin, and he wins back the title. So in the span of 2 hours, DDP lost and won back the championship. And for those wondering, whatever happened to Ric Flair in the mental hospital, you'll be happy to know that Flair got out a week later, and he explained that Arn Anderson had bailed him out. I didn't know that's how it worked when you're committed to an insane asylum, that if you want to get out, all you need to do is have someone post bail for you. Seems kind of dangerous to me. I can only imagine somebody listening to this who never watched WCW a day in their lives. All they know is John Cena and Randy Orton. What they must be thinking. It either sounds like the worst show in the world or the best. I feel like there's no in between. And I will say, it does sound more entertaining than what they force-feed us on Raw on most weeks. Okay, but 2 years later, and this is important, 2 years after this, there was no WCW. So there is something to be said, I think, for at least trying to have things make sense. So that brings us to our final match in the countdown next week. We've got one match left in the countdown. So good luck guessing what it is. Follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. You can vote in our Raw poll every Monday night as soon as the show goes off the air. I am off to the Evolve show here in a few hours. We'll have a report on the podcast next week. And again, you can follow along on Twitter if anything important happens. We got one more podcast left before I head out to Dallas for WrestleMania. And I anticipate that we'll probably do a couple of shows, including our usual roundtables with Noah Mark and Brian Blade while we're down there. So that's something to look forward to here in the next few weeks. And just want to say happy birthday, Sky. You know who you are. And we will be back next weekend. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and we will see you back here for more of the Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan's WCW contract splattered all over the internet. He got a $2 million signing bonus, 25% of the ticket revenue from all Nitro and Thunder events that he appeared on. He also got $20,000 per month for as long as he was part of the NWO, 50% of the profits from any Hulk Hogan merchandise that was sold, and a minimum $675,000 for any pay-per-view he appeared on. You know what I say? I say good for him. If I could get that kind of deal for myself, if somebody wanted me that badly, they were that stupid, then great. Always ask for what you feel you're worth. Your boss should have the guts to say no. WCW wanted to blow this guy so badly, they put a towel down on the floor so they wouldn't get rug burned.
Solomonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.